This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The declassification this weekend of an intelligence memo presented to President Bush a month before 9/11 has done little to resolve the controversy about whether the administration failed to take the threat from al-Qaeda seriously enough. The president's critics, mostly Democrats, say that the presidential daily brief from August 6, 2001 should have triggered alarms. The president's defenders, mostly Republicans, say the memo has no specific warnings. We'll explore different interpretations of the now famous PDB, get reaction from Congress, and talk with a former CIA agent who published an article bitterly critical of U.S. counterterror operations against al-Qaeda in August 2001. And we'll bring you an update on Iraq later in the program. If you have questions about the context and the meaning of the now famous August 6th memo, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is David Gergen. He worked at the White House for four presidents, Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, Ronald Reagan, and Bill Clinton. He's now director for the Center of Public Leadership at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, and he's with us from his office in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Very nice to talk to you today, David.
Nice to talk to you again, Neil.
Tell us about the PDB. How closely is this held?
It probably has the smallest circulation of anything written in Washington. And it's held very closely. It is written, Neil, is written essentially for the president himself. It is shared with the vice president. It is shared with the National Security Council staff director. It's shared with the Secretary of State. But within the White House, it's very closely held. On occasions, the chief of staff of the White House has also been a recipient of the daily brief. But essentially, it's the overnight report from the agency of collecting reports they've received from around the world and assembling them into a coherent, digestible form. Up until this presidency, and I would assume in continuing through this presidency, it's typically about 10 to 20 pages in length.
And you were communications director, a very senior position under President Reagan. You would not have seen the PDB.
I would ordinarily not see it. There were times when I was asked to read it. I was cleared for appropriate high-level documents, but I was not on the regular circulation list. That's correct. And I would see it on an as-needed basis. But it's also important to understand that if there were that the information that's in the PDB is then repackaged in a variety of ways with less reference to, say, sourcing. But if there are general alarm bells going off in the government, others will be brought in pretty quickly through other forms, other memos, but not this one. This one is for the personal use of the president. It's what normally starts the president's day, and it's a background paper, in effect, for the CIA representative then coming to the Oval Office and briefing the president in the morning. And presidents in the past have ordinarily started their morning. That's the first meeting in the morning is with the CIA over the PDB, joined by the NSC advisor, sometimes joined by the chief of staff, to review the events of the day. So the president's up to speed and knows what's happening in the world and can ask appropriate policy questions or begin to frame follow-up meetings with his own team.
And do those questions start during the briefing itself? I mean, does the president read it with all those advisors present and then say, what about this, what about that?
No, it's ordinarily something that's done in a very, very small meeting. It's simply the CIA director, the CIA representative walks in. Occasionally, the CIA director will join that session, but it's a daily meeting with the head of the CIA. And during the Cold War, It was religiously done, and it was a very, very high priority. Once the Cold War ended and there was some pressure off, Bill Clinton did not necessarily meet with the CIA to start every one of his days. He might be running doing something else. But ordinarily, the CIA is wherever the president is, wherever he's traveling. They will be there that morning to talk about the PDB. It's delivered to the president before he comes into the session, and then there's a very, very tight small meeting. After that meeting is over, the president may bring in his Secretary of State, or he may have his NSC advisor and his chief of staff and two or three others to figure out, okay, we know where we are in the world. Now we need to do some follow-up. Let's task for this or task for that. And I think that's what's at issue here about this PDB. what happened once it was over.
Now, this page and a half from that briefing, what do you make of it? I mean, should this have sent up alarm bells, do you think?
I think to be fair to the White House, it is right that there's no actionable evidence presented here. There's nothing on which they could take automatic action. But I do think that one would want to know, and if you're on the commission, you'd want to know a lot more information once you see this. And that is, first question is, what else was in a PDB that day? It would be my expectation that this would be one item among several in a PDB that day. Was it the top item, or was it like the number four? You know, was it the lead, or was it number four? That in itself gives you some sense of how much urgency the CIA attached to it. Secondly, you'd want to know how many other kinds of warnings had been coming through from the agency, from others, that had preceded this, and where had they pointed? Was this one among many, and was it sort of like, and would the others had a lot more urgency about overseas threats? You'd want to know that at the very least. And then you would want to know, okay, what happened afterwards? And I have to tell you, looking at it of itself, while much of it is historical, as Condi Rice said in her testimony, the last two paragraphs, I think, the flags go up because it does talk about much more recent activity, more recent threats, FBI conducting full field. I would think the president would want to know who the heck is following up in this in my government, and I need to get back to me on this. I need to know more about this because this is suggesting there's something that's going on, suspicious activity right now. Who's on top of this? What do we know? And I think those are questions that the commission will want to probe pretty heavily this week.
Let's get a question from a listener. Juan joins us on the line from Greensboro, North Carolina.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I had the pleasure of hearing Mr. Gergen speak on leadership and when he went to Elon.
Yes.
And
I remember that well.
Yeah, it was really a great speech. Speeches, rather. And you had said some really nice things about the president, but one of the things that I recall you saying that concerned you was his lack of curiosity.
Yes.
And I think, don't you think that his possible reading of the memo might, the daily briefing might be affected by that?
That's a very appropriate question, and I that's exactly what the commission ought to be following up on. And I might say, Juan, yesterday, David Broder, the dean of the political press corps, wrote a column in the Washington Post on precisely the question of did President Bush set up a structure in which information flowed up to him, but in which he showed very little curiosity and he didn't ask questions down the line, and did he not know as much as a president should know as a result of his incuriosity? And Broder said, by contrast, President Kennedy, he was of course deeply into foreign policy as president, was an intensely curious person. He was a journalist. He had some journalistic background, and he frequently would call desk officers in the State Department, asking, "What the hell is this? I'm reading this in my Oval Office. Tell me what this. Give me some background on this." And I continue to believe that while there are many, George W. Bush has many, many fine qualities, this lack of curiosity may be haunting his presidency.
Juan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
David Gergen, as you look at the controversy that is developing, do you think that those of us who don't have the insider context of how these things work at the White House, are we treating this issue fairly? What jumps out at you?
My sense, Neil, and I can't speak for all the media. I haven't seen it. But my sense is the response in the last 48 hours has been actually very balanced. Maybe there are some outriders out there, but by and large, as far as I can tell, people are trying to figure this out rather than leaping to conclusions. Oh, wow, there was nothing here. The White House had nothing to worry about, except for some partisans. And then on the other side, while there are some partisans saying you obviously blew it, I think people are saying, let's get more pieces of this puzzle in place before we do it. I think the press is taking a fairly, I think the press, as far as I can tell, has been more in the area of probing. I think that all of us are, we're 9/11 was such a strike out of the blue that, and for all of us, that I think that it's just something that we don't want to contemplate, that we could, you know, that a president administration, you know, if it just been more aggressive, could have stopped. I think it's hard for us to deal with that. I think it's a painful thought, and I think most press people are being pretty careful about this right now. So I do think that Neil, I'll put it this way. I think while it's important to understand the context of how these PDBs are written, you're asking the right kind of questions about it, I also think that there's enough right there on the face of it that you can begin to figure it out for yourself about whether you think the administration was curious and aggressive enough. It seems to me there is. I read the PDB and saying, I now understand why Dick Clark felt there was a lack of urgency, because so far as we've heard, there were no sort of like, you know, really big follow-up meetings trying to pursue this. But I'd like to know more. I mean, I'd like to hear what the FBI folks now say and what they heard from the White House. But it does seem to me the PDB does suggest, and then the fact that there were no big meetings that we're aware of yet, where was the urgency to deal with this? Did they really think that this was something that they could deal with on a business-as-usual basis, or did they really were trying to hustle it up? And that was the gist of Clark's argument. He felt that there wasn't enough urgency. But in fairness to the president, I do think we need more information, and I think the value of this commission is also beginning to come into focus now. It's useful to have a bipartisan commission with people aggressively asking questions on both sides. I think it's useful to the country. It's opened this process up in ways that hold governments accountable, and I think that's very important for us.
And obviously more on that, particularly on law enforcement, later in the week. David Gergen, thanks very much.
Neil, it's good to talk to you again.
David Gergen, White House advisor to four presidents, now director of the Center for Public Leadership at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. He spoke to us from his office in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And by the way, if you've not read the PDB of August 6, 2001, you can see a copy on our website at npr.org. And we're going to be joined now by two experts in intelligence. Judith Yaffe, a former senior intelligence analyst on Middle Eastern and Persian Gulf issues at the CIA, who wrote PDBs for Presidents Reagan, Bush Sr., and President Clinton, now a senior research fellow at the National Defense University at Fort McNair, Washington, D.C. She's with us here in Studio 3A. And John Arquilla, who's a professor of defense analysis and director of the Center on Terrorism and Irregular Warfare at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. We just have a few seconds left in this segment of the program. David Gergen went on a little longer, and I think it was well worth it. But Judith Yaffe, let's get your initial reaction to the PDB of August 6th.
I think people expect a lot more from these art forms than can be normally delivered. Intelligence is an art, not a science. And I think it's rare that you will find smoking guns in any of this. If there's a smoking gun that will suddenly come across an analyst's desk, that will be taken downtown immediately. You don't wait for the next morning and the PDB. PDB provides information that may have come in overnight, but also analysis that's been worked on, anything from, say, national intelligence estimates, running the key judgments in them, issues that are known to be important to the president. And in a case like this, it's not just history. It is saying, how do we know that to say what we're saying to be able to predict behavior? Because there usually is a track record, fingerprints, I mean, not literally, but figuratively, mm-hmm. in terms of behavior that gives you something to predict. How do I know what I know? This is how I know what I know.
And we'll begin the next segment with a reaction from John Arquilla. And I apologize, John, but we'll get to you right after the break. So stay with us. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Send us email, totn@npr.org. Back shortly. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On Saturday, the White House declassified a presidential daily briefing from August 6, 2001, titled Bin Laden Determined to Strike in the U.S. The memo had been discussed but not disclosed during hearings looking into the events leading up to 9/11. If you have questions, join us, 800-989-8255, or email us, TOTN at NPR.org. Just before the break, we heard from Judith Yaffe, a senior research fellow at the National Defense University. And joining us now is John R. Quill, a director of the Center on Terrorism and Irregular Warfare at the Naval Postgraduate School. And John, again, apologies, but let's get your reaction to the memo that, as you saw it. What did you read into it?
What I see is a national debate about the fundamental problem of warning and response. In the intelligence business, this is the core of all activities. How do we tie together warnings and respond in an accurate and timely way? And it's always hard to do this. Pearl Harbor was a case where our system, the intelligence and military organs, knew the Japanese would attack, the president knew, and they put the Philippines on alert, but not Pearl Harbor. Before D-Day, 60 years ago, the Germans knew the Allies were going to land somewhere in France, and the day before the invasion, they put the 15th Army and the Pas-de-Calais on alert, but not the 7th Army in Normandy. And so it is with 9-1-1. There were lots of indicators here that something was coming, but it's hard to pinpoint. And basically, we break this down into two kinds of warning. One is strategic and one is tactical. When it comes to 9-1-1, there were a number of strategic indicators. My colleague from RAND, David Ronfelt, and I were writing 8-9 years ago that terrorists were forming networks and were going to be very much harder to detect, to track, and to counter in the future, and that we needed to start thinking in terms of countering networks rather than focusing on rogue nations. Another kind of strategic warning was that the Armed Islamic Group in 1994 seized a French airliner, and we know that they wanted to convince the pilot to fly that plane into the Eiffel Tower. He, of course, said, mais non, and didn't do it, and they were down on the ground refueling, and French commandos killed them. But we've known for 10 years that planes could be turned into missiles. And finally, of course, the World Trade Center was the subject of an attack in 1993, and we know terrorists like to go back. It's a little murkier at the tactical level, but there were still tactical warnings. There was a fellow in custody for weeks who wanted to learn how to turn planes but not take them off or land them. There were some confidential informants living with a couple members of the attack cell, I think, in San Diego. There were reports out of the United Arab Emirates. And it seems to me that on balance, we see another of these classic cases of not linking warning to response. And I think partly for one of the reasons David Gergen suggested, the PDB is one of the most closely held documents in government. Well, look, I think good intelligence depends on networking, not on stovepiping information. If you create lines of authority and fewer people see things, well, then you're going to have less a chance of intercepting an attack. And our institutions all measure their power in terms of what information they control. In a network age, we have to measure that power in terms of the information we share with other trusted members.
Judith Yaffe, you've described the construction of these documents as an art form. And one of the things we continually hear about, and it's perfectly true, there was a huge volume of intelligence, all of these, the so-called spike and the chatter and all of that sort of stuff. But this is the stuff that was winnowed out, presumably.
I don't know what was winnowed out. I think part of the problem is that the information you get on terrorist planning at the tactical level is never going to be the best. The people who tell you these kind of things are not your neighbor next door or the librarian or someone whose reliability you may trust. There'll be people who are part of these organizations or a similar organization who may be telling you for their own motive, for their own reason. And it's only through hindsight that you can really go back and be very clever and connect the dots. The much more difficult is to do it beforehand. I would point out, and I worked 3 years in the Counterterrorism Center, that if there were to be a warning issued on every report that came in claiming there was an attack, the mechanism immediately would go out of existence. People, the more you warn, it's like crying wolf. The less people pay attention to it. And I'll also point out that my experience was in warning about, for example, airline threats. The airline companies, for example, did not like that because any kind of a warning put out might have hurt their hurt business, hurt travel. So you have a lot of pressures working against you. But basically, in the end, art form, because you have to take a lot of disparate bits of information to see, does this take the story further ahead? Are we there? Mm-hmm. If you get a real clear bit of evidence, you don't wait for the PDB.
Let's get another call there in. This is Gary, who's with us from Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
Good afternoon, Neil.
Afternoon.
I am a captain, a Boeing 767 captain for one of the two major carriers that was attacked on September 11th. I can't disagree more strongly than with Ms. Jaffe about what was winnowed out. I'm looking at the PDB here right in front of me, and it says very clearly that the FBI indicated patterns of suspicious activity in this country consistent with patterns for hijackings. On September 11th, I was sitting on my bed watching CNN as the airplane struck the towers. That was the first I heard of this. And if it is true that the administration, this administration, bowed to the concerns of the airlines in not informing the crew members, such as myself, then there is a gross failure of responsibility on the part of this administration, because apparently James Woods, the actor, you may have heard about this, was on a flight on one of the two airlines when he observed four or five of the hijackers to be conducting suspicious surveillance activities to the point where he advised the crew. Now, if the airlines had been notified by order of the administration, and if the crews, such as myself, had been notified, and if that crew had been notified, then that suspicious activity would have led to somebody meeting that aircraft when Mr. Woods and those potential hijackers walked off, and one questioning period on these individuals could have busted the entire thing wide open, and September 11th never would have happened. If something goes wrong on my airplane, I'm the ultimate authority. I'm responsible. And under the watch of this administration, George W. Bush, something went terribly wrong, and he is the individual that must be held accountable.
Judith Jaffe.
I would make one comment. I don't think we're that far apart. I said I didn't know what had been excluded or not. But there is a question. Can you warn the crews and not warn the public? There was a lot of criticism made a couple years ago when the government was warning or thinking about warning government officials not to fly or travel, not telling the traveling public that. I don't think you can distinguish one from the other, unfortunately. And I think, I sympathize with the problem. I understand what you're saying.
Well, hindsight is 20/20.
Always.
Of course, we're warning everybody about everything now. But still, at the end of the day, somebody has to be held responsible for this.
Well, I agree with you on that.
Gary, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you, Neil.
An email we have from Lynn Unnerstall in Washington, Missouri. When you have the capability of looking back on an action and comparing that to this memo, you can read into it whatever you want. I think that no matter who was president at that time, there's no possible way he could have foreseen what happened on September the 11th, 2001. If they had taken this memo and proposed a strike against bin Laden, do you think the public would have supported this without more information? Get a response, John Arquilla?
Again, I think there was a lot of strategic warning for a long time, knowing for a decade about planes being turned into missiles. Richard Clark has spoken openly now about his concern about something like this happening at the Atlanta Olympics in 96. The real art, of course, is crafting a policy that's not too alarmist but is still forceful. So, for example, switching airliners over to having a more fortified cockpits. The doctrine on commercial airlines was let the hijackers take over. Your responsibility is to get the passengers where they need to go. Well, knowing that planes can be turned into missiles might have encouraged some rethinking of the whole question of allowing a plane to be taken over.
And yet that was, to some degree, you hate to use this word, but the genius behind their plan.
Well, I think the genius is a group that has learned to ride the rails of our advanced technology to strike at us, and we have to look beyond aircraft. We mustn't simply defend against the last target, because what makes us rich and prosperous and powerful also makes us vulnerable, and we have to assume adversaries are thinking very insightfully about how to ride those rails to strike at us.
Thanks very much to you both. We appreciate your coming in today. John Arquilla, you just heard from Professor of Defense Analysis and Director of the Center on Terrorism and Irregular Warfare at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. He joined us from the studios of member station KAZU in Pacific Grove. Judith Jaffe is a former senior intelligence analyst on the Middle East and Persian Gulf issues at the CIA, now a senior research fellow at the National Defense University here in Washington, D.C., and was kind enough to come into Studio 3A. We've been hearing a great deal about how government and the media did not pay enough attention to the al-Qaeda threat prior to September the 11th. Consider these words, published in the Atlantic Monthly, August 2001. The United States has spent billions of dollars on counterterrorism since the U.S. Embassy bombings in Tanzania and Kenya in August of 1998. Tens of millions have been spent on covert operations specifically targeting Osama bin Laden and his terrorist organization, Al-Qaeda. Senior U.S. officials boldly claim that the CIA and the FBI are clandestinely picking apart bin Laden's organization limb by limb. But having worked for the CIA for nearly 9 years on Middle East matters, I would argue that America's counterterrorism program in the Middle East and its environs is a myth. The author of that passage is Reuel Gerecht. He's now a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He joins us by phone from his office in Washington, and good to have you on the program again.
My pleasure.
Why did you write that article?
Well, because I got a little tired of seeing the commentary in Washington about how much they were doing about fighting al-Qaeda and bin Ladenism. And it was clear to me that there was, I think, a disconnect, and one often sees this disconnect between what people in Washington believe that they are doing and what is actually occurring out in the field.
And one of the things you write about is that out in the field, people were not willing to get involved in programs that, I think, as you graphically put it, involved diarrhea.
Yeah, I mean, the way the agency has is structured, it's essentially around the type of, it has the same bureaucratic structure as it had in the 1940s when it came into being, and this really hasn't changed. That is, the vast majority of officers are located overseas under official cover. They are located in embassies and consulates and a few other places, but it's usually under an official cover. And that really allows minimal access to the types of individuals who would be involved in Islamic terrorism. This, the only way that you are going to effectively use intelligence offensively against this type of a group is to try to seed it, to try to put individuals inside of it. And we have been very, very reluctant to go in that direction. So we are essentially what we call a liaison-based intelligence service. That is, it is the cooperation between the CIA and foreign intelligence and security services, which are our frontline defense. And that sometimes works and sometimes doesn't.
Do you think that's still the case?
Yes. I think more so now than ever before. The growth of liaison intelligence started accelerating actually before 9/11. If you were to compare it to, say, 10 years ago, it has exploded after 9/11. It is without a doubt the primary vehicle we use to defend ourselves against Islamic terrorists. It has a place. It's just that I would feel much more comfortable if the agency were a bit more innovative and clever and started thinking about how you secrete individuals inside of these organizations, because I think that's the only way you're going to get into the inner circle.
We're speaking about the presidential daily briefing that was declassified over this weekend, titled Bin Laden Determined to Strike Inside the U.S. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Reuel Gerecht, when you wrote this article back in August 2001, or you must have written it before then, you'd just come back from Peshawar, the city in northwest Pakistan that's near the famous Khyber Pass, the entrance to Afghanistan then and now. And you wrote about at the time that this was a crossroads of terrorist groups from around the world, that the people who were involved in the bombing of the American embassies may have come back through Peshawar to return to the arms of bin Laden in Afghanistan. And at the time, you pointed out that the United States and Pakistan were not allies in this fight.
Yeah, I think many American officials at that time would have considered them allies, but I think it has become clear in the 9/11 Commission, the hearings, that one of the major obstacles to the United States getting serious about bin Laden was our relationship with Pakistan. The Pakistanis were instrumental in developing the camps inside of Afghanistan that bin Laden started using, in some cases taking over, as of 1996. These camps were set up by the Pakistanis. Musharraf was an instrumental force. General Musharraf, now President Musharraf, was an instrumental force in using these camps to train militants to attack the Indians in Kashmir. We were very, very reluctant to cross the Pakistanis, who were the primary backers of the Taliban. We were very reluctant to increase our support to Ahmad Shah Massoud, who was the leader of the Northern Alliance, because the Pakistanis hated him. And until we were willing to change our relationship with the Pakistanis, we were essentially stalemated both in Pakistan and, I would say even more importantly, up north in the area that Massoud controlled in the Panjshir Valley, which was face-to-face with Taliban and al-Qaeda forces.
And, of course, it was the assassination just a couple of days before 9/11 of Ahmad Shah Massoud that preceded the 9/11 attacks.
Correct.
Yeah. Roel Gerecht, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Roel Gerecht was a CIA case officer specializing in the Middle East. He's now a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He was with us from his office here in Washington. Now with us on the line from Miami, Florida, is Democratic Senator, former presidential candidate Bob Graham. Good to have you back on the program.
Neil, thank you very much.
As you read the, I'm sure you read the memo over the weekend, what was your reaction to that?
My reaction was that much of the information in there was, as Dr. Rice had said, historic, but the tone of the statement, the sense of urgency of something about to happen, you would have thought would have jarred the president into coming back from Crawford and instituting a series of actions that might have reduced the possibility of this occurring.
Now, a lot of people have asked questions about, obviously, what the administration does. The media has come in for its share of criticism as well. But a lot of people are also asking, where was Congress at the time? You were chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Do you feel you pressed the intelligence community enough on this point?
The answer is no. We should have pushed them harder. We were relying too much on what we were being told, that was a mistake.
And in retrospect, what might you have done?
Well, I think that there are several things that should have been done. One is we should have been looking at the basic structure of our intelligence community. We basically had, on September the 11th, a Cold War intelligence capability. We didn't have the kinds of people on the ground, whether it was in Afghanistan or in the United States, that were had the greatest possibility of ferreting out the activities of these 19 terrorists and Osama bin Laden. We also had numerous instances in which there were missed communications or failure of one U.S. intelligence or law enforcement agency to communicate with each other, maybe the most significant being the fact that the CIA knew of the terrorist inclinations of two of the 19 hijackers who were inside the United States from January of 2000 until they flew a plane into the Pentagon on September the 11th, and it was only...
And, Senator, I'm afraid we're going to have to cut you off. We'll continue the conversation after the break with Senator Bob Graham. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and here are a couple of the stories NPR News is working on this afternoon. President Bush and Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak said today they would welcome an Israeli withdrawal from Gaza. President Bush is set to meet with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon later this week. And the mayor of Detroit, Kwame Kilpatrick, has proposed a layoff of nearly 400 city employees as part of an effort to eliminate a $264 million projected budget gap for the next fiscal year. The city's bus system would get the most layoffs. We'll have details on those stories later today on All Things Considered from NPR News. Tomorrow on Talk of the Nation, what happens when the auditors get an audit? A new report on the IRS shows a steep decline in the number of business and corporations that get scrutinized. More on that story tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. In a few minutes, we'll get an update on Iraq from Anthony Shadid of the Washington Post, who's in Baghdad. But first, let's finish our conversation with Senator Bob Graham, Democrat of Florida. Before the break, we were talking about the presidential daily briefing, and we wanted to switch the subject and talk now a little bit about Iraq and what the future lies ahead there, Senator Graham. And at the moment, the president is sticking firmly to his handover date of June the 30th. Given all that's happened, the surge of violence in Iraq over the past couple of weeks or so, and shows no sign of abating, do you think that's that sticking to that date is wise?
No, it's interesting how the president has taken a different position on the roadmap for peace in the Middle East, where he rejected the idea of having calendar dates as the driving force for movements towards a ultimate peace agreement, whereas in Iraq, we have a very red or green light date on June the 30th. I think that we ought to stick with the approach that we've used in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which is we will take steps as conditions on the ground justify them. And it's hard to see how conditions on the ground in Iraq today likely to be similar on the 30th of June warrant a transfer of sovereignty to a yet-to-be-determined governmental entity in Iraq.
Yet having announced that date and stuck to it, would not now rescheduling it, might that send a signal of wavering and weakness?
No, I think it would show the opposite, that we're not just bailing out of Iraq because there's a presidential election coming up in November, that we're going to stay there, as the president indicated in the days after the war in Iraq started. We're going to stay there till we have completed the job. The job is not yet completed, and it's highly unlikely that it will be completed by the 30th of June.
Now let's get a caller involved in the conversation. Gary's on the line with us from Washington, D.C.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And I'll try to be brief. It appears to me that in the 9/11 context, the requirement for actionable intelligence seemed to be an exact date and time of the attack. But in the Iraq context, actionable intelligence seemed to be vague rumors about uranium purchases in Africa. I'd like you to comment on the difference between those two standards.
Well, I think they are two different standards. And I think the idea that you will only move to protect yourself when you can see the silver bullet, where someone sends you a notice that we're going to attack on Tuesday morning, September the 11th, in New York and at the Pentagon, that is ridiculous. You're never going to get that kind of clarity. When the president knew that there was contemporary reporting that there was a serious potential of an attack inside the United States by aircraft which had been hijacked, that should have been enough to cause the president, for instance, to have directed the FAA to immediately inform commercial airlines of this and to develop a policy in terms of the instructions to pilots of hijacked airplanes as to what they were supposed to do. In the past, their lessons, their directions were to acquiesce, to be passive, to get the plane on the ground. In light of the fact that we now had information that the purpose of hijacking was to use the plane as a weapon of mass destruction, different instructions would have been appropriate.
And it's such a strong contrast with what was required in the Iraq case, apparently to me.
I agree there is a contrast. I don't think there's a rational basis for the action that was taken in those critical days prior to September the 11th. And for that and a number of other reasons, September the 11th was an avoidable tragedy.
Well, some people would say, and perhaps President Bush has said it several times, that September the 11th changed things, including perhaps the kind of intelligence they were willing to act upon.
Well, if you take the position that we've got to wait until 3,000 Americans have lost their lives before we act, I guess that would be an acceptable answer. I don't think we can tolerate that. That's one of the realities in the era in which we're now living, is we can't wait to be attacked. We have got to exercise preemptory steps based on the best and most credible intelligence. It's a little odd that the president used preemptory military action against Iraq, but was unwilling to conceive of the need for preemptory defense within our own country.
Gary, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And Senator Graham, we thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Neil.
Bye-bye. Bob Graham, a Democrat from Florida at the time of 9/11, was the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. He was with us on the line from Miami. We did request interviews with several Republican senators who've spoken out on these issues. None of those were able to speak with us today.